Get ready for brilliant people, brilliant ideas, and a regular good time. This is Brilliant Thoughts with Success People editor Tristan Almada, the show that thinks about how personalities, relationships, and communication shape business success. And now here he is, Tristan Almada.
Every once in a while, I get to interview someone that blows my mind. And Jim Harder was that person for this week. Now, anyone who reads the news is always hearing about Gallup polls. They're constantly studying public opinion. And while their most prominent polls are in politics, they do a lot of research into the workplace. And Jim Harder is their chief scientist leading those studies. In fact, he's led over 1,000 studies on workplace effectiveness. He's written 4 books about those projects. And the fourth one, that's the one we'll be talking about. It's called Well-Being at Work, just came out. Jim gave me a lot to think about. Here's our conversation. Welcome back to another episode of Brilliant Thoughts with Success. And today I've got Jim Harder. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tristan. Good to be with you today.
Well, dude, I'm excited because I did a lot of research on you and I read your new book, Well-Being at Work, How to Build Resilient and Thriving Teams. And I'm very, very impressed. I actually have a ton of questions for you because not only is this podcast focused on solopreneurs and entrepreneurs and just helping people in general grow businesses, but dude, I've got 3 businesses I run and I was like, whoa, I never thought of that. I need to try this. I need to try that. So tell me, the idea behind the book, where did it come from?
Well, at Gallup, we had been studying well-being. It actually goes back to our founder, George Gallup's work, where he had conducted global studies of different parts of the world, not a complete global study, but different parts of the world, studied, you know, what made people live long lives and all that. But in the early 2000s, we really started organizing all that research, and we asked a question. Are there some commonalities in people who live really good lives and have really good days? And we found there were 5 elements. We summarized that research in 2010 in a book called Well-Being, the 5 Essential Elements. That was directed at individuals. So really mainly trying to help individuals think about what they can do to impact all 5 of the elements that we found that people can do something about. And we noticed there's a big gap, had been a real big gap in organizations in that leaders and managers didn't have good advice for how they could build thriving teams. And we'd also started tracking some consistent changes in the workplace that weren't really for the positive, increases in worry and stress globally, increases in anger, sadness, and not real good among workers. You know, some negative characteristics in organizations that had begun or starting to become kind of systemic. And so we saw a big gap in that leaders and managers didn't have kind of the best collated science that they could apply to change their culture. So this book was really written for leaders and managers to help them think about how they can go about changing a culture that builds a resilient workforce where they can attract stars and where they can impact the kinds of outcomes that they really want to impact.
I love that. Did you change any of the ideas that you originally had in the book through COVID as we were experiencing that?
We actually started outlining the book before we knew anything about COVID. And then, yeah, it heavily influenced what we wrote because many of the patterns that we had been tracking pre-COVID became really magnified, amplified. So we saw pre-COVID huge increases in diversity in workforces, increases in the amount of remote work, not to the magnitude we experienced at COVID, but we started seeing patterns there. We'd already been studying remote work and what works best, what doesn't. Increases in how matrixed people were inside organizations, where you've got people working with multiple teams and multiple team leaders. And of course, digitization, mobile technology has evolved significantly over time. and there become more gig work. And the most desired perk pre-COVID, guess what it was?
Most desired work pre-COVID to work from home. Perk.
Yeah.
To work from home?
Flex time. Yeah. Flex time. Only about 5% of people worked from home full time pre-COVID. And that jumped up to about 48% at peak during COVID. 70% of people were working from home some of the time. And most of those, a lot of those were most of the time. So 70% were experiencing some type of work from home activity during COVID. And
that's super high. That's way higher than I thought.
Yeah. The other kind of patterns we saw in the workforce during COVID, or pre-COVID, were that the workforce was starting to expect something different from their employer. They were looking for a job with a purpose. And we found, as we've studied workplaces in different recessionary times of the past, that the workplaces that did the best during recessions really leveraged their purpose, so they could help people see how their work connects to something bigger than just their job. That helps people get through tough times, I think. People were asking for development at work, not just a satisfying job where work and life are separate, but the number one reason people were changing jobs was career development. But unfortunately, when people changed jobs, they didn't change jobs within the same company. They'd look outside the company because they weren't seeing the developmental opportunities inside the company. So development's a big one.
We noticed that a lot in companies that are startups in Silicon Valley. Those that I talk to, they're hoping that these companies can grow fast enough, but if they're not, they're out, right? They go to something else where they feel they can grow faster.
Yeah, people, this younger generation of workers is going to, they'll switch work pretty quickly, and they'll look for development more quickly. They won't be as, they won't just hold out for tenure and, you know, the past kind of systems we had in organizations were people just expect to work up through the ranks. We also, another really big pattern I thought was before COVID hit, people were expecting their workplace to improve their overall life. They expected more of a blending of work and life than in the past. When I grew up, work and life were kind of separate things. You know, work's over here and the rest of my life's over here. A lot of it due to technology and due to the fact that we're carrying around these phones with us every day and all the time, and work and life are more naturally blended. But an expectation of an employer that I expect you to improve my life, not just give me a job. That was a big one.
Okay, so can you expand on that part? When you're saying life, what does that include? Does that include like personal, mental, emotional, extended family type thing, like spouse, siblings, and so forth? What does that look like?
Really, everything that a person is willing to share about the rest of their life. We found that the most foundational element of well-being, and arguably the most important, all things being equal, is your career, because it touches so many other parts of your life. It impacts your social life. It impacts your finances. It impacts your health. It impacts your standing in your community and how you get involved in your community. But those five I just listed, your career well-being, your social well-being, your financial well-being, your physical well-being, and your community well-being are the five we found that are generalizable across the world in terms of, you know, people's ability to impact them and their importance.
Were those the five essential elements from that different book?
Can
you please repeat those just in case our audience wants those?
Yeah, I'll give you the five and just a one-sentence definition of each. So career well-being is liking what you do every day. Social well-being is having meaningful friendships. Financial well-being is managing your money well. Physical well-being is having enough energy to get things done. And community well-being is liking where you live. Now, there's obviously a lot more depth in each of those, but that's the, if you're going to pull one thing away from each of those, that'd be the main takeaway.
Jim, now I have to read that book, man. Now I have to go and order it right now and read it. Okay, so.
Well, we summarize them in the new one too. So it's,
okay,
there's
good.
There's some overlap.
There was one section in the book towards the end. I don't remember what page it was. I just wrote it down in my notes because I thought, wow, this is a really powerful sentence. I'm going to read it to you, and then you tell me what the intent of it was. And it says, your organization's best potential to create a net thriving culture starts when you master the elements of well-being most closely linked to work. This is because the work itself is a bridge to trust. And I thought that engulfed a big piece of the book in this one sentence. Tell me about that.
Yeah, getting the order right is really important. A lot of companies have tried wellness programs and tried to, in a well-intended way, improve well-being. But I think if you get ahead of the basics, it doesn't come across as well-intended, and people don't know, it doesn't absorb quite as well. So if you start with the basics, what I'd call the nuts and bolts of managing, when people come to work, they want to know what's expected of them. They want to know what their role is. They want to have what they need to do their work. They want to have a chance to do what they do best. So to do that, you've got to get to know something about their strengths and help them use their strengths every day. When they do something well, they want to be recognized for it. They want to feel cared about. They want somebody who cares about them, who knows them as an individual. And, you know, so much of what happens with employee engagement, for instance, and well-being is very individual and situational. And managers are in the only position in the organization that can really know those individuals and situations. And that's why they're so important conduits to getting this right. But when you get those basic elements right, you give people a chance to develop, you connect their work to a bigger purpose. What you're doing is you're starting to meet the expectations that workers have when they join your organization. And they see that there's the trade-off they expected, and you start building trust. When you start building trust inside an organization, people don't second guess leadership and what they're trying to get done. They're more likely to listen to the strategies of leadership. They're more likely to cooperate with their coworkers. They're more likely to cooperate across teams, which is really important. A lot of times in organizations, teams get siloed, and the managers, you know, kind of develop an us versus them mentality instead of we're all in this together and here's why. So it goes a long ways when you get those basics right. And then people start listening to and paying attention to everything you're trying to get done from a well-being perspective, whether you have policies, programs, perks, whatever you have available, your benefits, all that stuff gets absorbed in a very different way if people get their basic needs met.
I love that. And I liked one piece that you said there. I mean, everything was great, Jim, but there was one thing that stood out because it was at the very beginning you said of that talk, when people come to work, they want to know what they need to do, like what's expected of me. And I think that's where a lot of the newer companies, they miss that. And then they wonder why they're failing so bad. Are they hiring bad? Did they hire the wrong people? What are they doing? I think that's a big key. And then you also mentioned that the manager is such a strong key person to keeping the organization together. And I agree, because as I've seen these massive companies grow that I help or that I'm just part of, sometimes the person that started it was that person. I was the person that was making mm-hmm. you feel good and saying, hey, how's your family? And then it's gone. And they're like, what happened? Right? There's a loss there. How do we go about being able to hire at the right time? Do you know? Have you delved into that? To be able to capture that person to replace you, that hey, like I'm the chief happiness person, the chief culture person, that person that then disappears when the CEO who created the company is no longer there for that. Mm-hmm. When is it that we hire that person? How do we know?
How do we know they're the right person?
How do we know they're the right person, and how do we know when we're supposed to do that? Because I think that the CEOs try to move so fast because they're the visionaries, right? They're the ones that are created and just say, hey, go here, go there, go there. And it becomes a challenge, right? Because they're no longer there to say, hey, Jim, how's your family? How are you doing?
Oh, because there's a distance as the organization grows, right?
Yeah, there's a loss there. Yeah. How do we know when to hire that person so that doesn't happen to us?
Well, I think it comes down to knowing how to go about having a strategy for how you hire managers in the first place. So it's not just that person. It's how the messages of the CEO get, you could use the word cascaded, but get messaged throughout the organization and accepted throughout the organization. And whether people deeper into the organization as it grows feel there's some authenticity and some, so leaders can send messages about here's what we value. But if the managers aren't endorsing that and saying, here's how this fits into our work, and if there's not trust in leadership at a local level, then all those values just kind of go on deaf ears. We did a review of over 100 companies and their value statements, and they came out very similar, but a pretty small percentage of people said that they really believed in the organization's values. So you can write the best value statements, but unless you have your managers actually helping people connect their work to that and making it real. So I would, to answer your question, Tristan, I would say it has to do with your strategy for how you continually hire the best possible the managers with the best potential. And there are systems for doing that effectively. We've had a chance at Gallup to study successful managers in a lot of different fields, and there are some common traits that they have that you can select for. But the other side of it is, the other half of it is how you upskill those managers over time so that they know how to have the right kinds of conversations with people. So even if you've got a company now where you've already grown and hired a bunch of people that are in the managerial role, you better be thinking about how they can be upskilled to move from what the traditional role was of a boss to more like a coach. And there's some fundamentals to getting that right.
That always reminds me of the show. I don't know if you've watched the show, Billions. Have you ever seen Billions, or have you heard of Billions?
I have.
You know, the productivity coach or that psychologist, the one that they walk into, that's what that reminds me of. That person that kind of makes you feel good, reminds you that you can do it, right? So that's what it reminded me of right
now. Another big part of it, though, is how you continually reset priorities. So if you're not in touch with your people and you've got organizational changes, let's say leadership has changed the direction they want to go. If you don't have the translators for that and the ones who know what people are actually working on and helping them say, here's what we need to change to and here's why. The why is always really important. So they know. So that expectations thing that you mentioned, only about half of people globally clearly know what's expected of them in their work. So there's a big gap right there in a lot of organizations, just getting that right and making sure that the translation happens appropriately. When people know what they're supposed to do and know why, and actually have some involvement in setting their own goals, you've gone a long ways.
Yeah, that's very true, which kind of then reminds me of the part of your book that talks about building a culture and what was it? Net thriving. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I thought that's the very first time I've ever heard of it. So can you go over that, please?
Yeah. So we're always looking at Gallup. We're always looking for the best questions, and we design questions all the time. We're always looking for the ones that capture the most information in the simplest way where anybody in the world could answer the question. And we found a two-part question that gives us a really good metric. And it came from a researcher named Hadley Cantrell at Princeton. He used to partner with George Gallup, our founder, back in the 60s, so quite a while ago. But we've asked this all over the world, literally 160 plus countries, and it works. And we asked people to imagine a ladder with steps from 0 at the bottom to 10 at the top, where 0 represents the worst possible life and 10 represents the best possible life. And everybody can respond to where they're at on that ladder. And that's part of what we think of as the reflective self or the remembering self, where you take a step back and say, here's where I'm at right now in my life. And then the follow-up question, really important, is where do you think you'll be 5 years from now? So that's a measure of hope. So you combine those two together, 7 plus on the present, 8 plus on the future, and you've got what we call thriving. And that's linked to a lot of really positive life outcomes, better health, less daily worry and stress. And now that doesn't tell you what to do, but it gives you a good overall macro level metric of the people in your organization, where they're at. And then you can bring in some diagnostics around the five elements we talked about earlier to improve on that. But one of the things we learned in this exploration for this book was that we've known a lot about employee engagement over the years and how it predicts all kinds of outcomes. And we listed off just a little bit ago, Tristan, some of the elements that go into that, you know, clear expectations, recognition, getting people in the right role and all that. But engagement's not enough anymore. You could be engaged but not thriving in your overall life, and you still have a high probability of burnout because the rest of your life isn't aligned with what you're trying to get done at work. So you've got kind of some barriers. You could think of burnout as kind of the opposite of flow. we've all experienced flow at one time or another where we really feel like we're absorbed in our work, where, you know, that time goes quickly. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi has spent his whole career staying that pretty much. But flow and burnout, while they appear as opposites, they have one thing in common: high challenge. They're both high challenge states. Burnout, you've got things getting in the way of what you're trying to get done. And flow, you don't. You're doing what you do best. And so the rest of our life impacts all that.
I like that, man, because I actually asked Jim Quick this question a couple of weeks ago. Jim Quick wrote the book Limitless. And I said, dude, what do you think of burnout? He goes, look, that just means that you're not focusing enough on your passion. And you said the exact same thing. Like, you're letting everything else get in the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true.
Very, very good answer. So when it comes down to this net thriving, how can we do these things individually? If we're just like a one person shop or a very small business, anything we can do to put these things in place so we can thrive?
The first thing, I think, is to think about your own well-being. You've got to get your own well-being right, because that'll make it authentic for the other people around you. So one thing, and this is probably more so for as organizations grow and they start providing resources for people to improve their well-being, but make sure that what you're trying to do for your employees maps back to those five fundamental elements as kind of an organizing structure. The reason I think that's so important is that people need to know why the different things you're doing for them exist. And if you've got an organizing structure, it helps a lot in that kind of process. So I would definitely use those five as a way to kind of organize what you're doing in your organization and how people are working together to do various things. You know, even you can take financial well-being. That seems like it might seem like an odd one that you're paying people, but you're supposed to help them manage their finance. We can provide resources for them to do that. You can also, people learn a lot through peer groups. If you got any group of employees, no matter what size, they can share ideas. People learn from peers. They're going to learn from peers much more than somebody who they think might make a lot more money than them or just be in a different kind of situation than them. So I think that facilitating peer groups works a lot. I mentioned work on your own well-being, but well-being has to start at the CEO's office in terms of not only saying this is important to us, but importantly, why it's important. And I would say there are two really important whys that people need to know about what you're doing with well-being. And one is, we're involved in this for our organization because it makes us more resilient. It makes us more creative. It makes us higher performing. That's a very transparent answer. The other is you've got a better chance of attracting future stars to your organization because you've got a reputation. Your culture begins to get a reputation. What happens inside organizations right now goes outside very quickly. So I think that reputational part of it is important. And as I mentioned earlier, the new workforce is asking for that. So it's kind of a requirement.
No, it's very true. I was just talking to somebody this morning about really being that company that attracts talent. And I think we forget that. We're always trying to chase it. But if you work on these things, because I wrote these down, like career well-being, social well-being, financial, physical, community well-being. If you actively work on these and continually see how you can better your company with these, you're going to start attracting some serious talent, right? And I think it's the opposite of what we've been taught in the past, where it's like, oh, you got to go out there and make like prospecting, like the old sales school, right? Like mm-hmm. like a used car salesman type thing. So I love your approach, man. There, you also mentioned the highest priority engagement items, and I have them here. I wrote them out. They were my expectations, my strengths, my developments, my opinions, my mission or purpose. Can you go over those and why they're so important?
Sure. My expectations is so important, kind of related to some of the things we were just talking about. People, when they join an organization, they want to know what their role is. And when people come to work and they're confused about what they're supposed to do, it's not good. That's the most foundational one. You could have great relationships in the workplace, and they become gripe sessions if people are confused about what they're supposed to do. And one of the kind of things under the hood on that one is that's really, really easy, kind of low-hanging fruit, is involve people in setting their own goals. If you involve them in setting their goals, expectations become clearer to them. There's more ownership and there's more context. So people know their jobs and they bring new information from their experiences at work that you may not know anything about. And they'll be, in many cases, people will set higher goals than you would ever set for them if you give them that option. So that's a really important foundational one. It's not as easy as people might think, where you might think, well, I just need to delegate better. It's not just that. It's involvement.
It's delegate what? Sometimes they don't even know what to delegate. It's like, what is it? What is it? It's like itemize the duties and tasks. And I love your idea, which is, look, when you found somebody and they're coming in and you have a base, right? Then say, hey, let's work on this together now. How do we expand this and expand your role? Because I may not know some of these things that you know.
They might be closer to the customers than you are.
Dude, I love that one a lot. So what about my strengths? What does that look like?
Well, it starts with identifying an individual's strengths. And it's a different way of approaching management from the traditional, we're going to help shore up your weaknesses and make you well-rounded. You start off by knowing that each one of us have innate abilities that are different. If you have kids, anybody who has multiple kids knows that they come out a little different and they have different strengths. One of them might be more analytical. One of them might be more of a showboat. You get different abilities naturally. It's part of the grand design, I think, is that when you have any kind of a small tribe of people, they've got, but we have to first understand what those are. So we've got a method it's called Clifton Strengths, named after one of our founders in this area of science, Don Clifton. And it's been completed by over 25 million people globally. And it helps people identify through a methodology what their top innate tendencies are, so that they can leverage those tendencies and share them with others. And it creates a language that just creates more efficient conversations and helps managers get people in a position where they can leverage those more often. It doesn't mean that people don't work on weaknesses. They still, everybody needs to work on competencies, but you can do it in a way that's unique to you. So that first item I mentioned, expectations, define the outcome that you want people to work toward. Don't expect them all to get there the same way, and utilize their strengths to help them get to those outcomes in a way that's unique to them. That kind of fuels that ownership component that we talked about earlier.
Which I love, by the way. And just, you brought up something right there, and I wanted just to remind the audience that the book, Now Discover Your Strengths, right? Is that what you're talking about from Gallup?
That was the first version of it. We now have a book called Strengths Finder 2.0. It's kind of a really short book, and it's got all the best content in it. But either of those are out there.
All right. So my development. So you're picking your strengths, right? You've identified what those are. Tell me about development now.
So the important thing about development is that we shouldn't expect everybody to develop in the same way. And knowing those first two, you know, what an individual's expectations are, the outcomes you're working toward, their strengths, gives you a real advantage in developing them, because then you can work through their development, through their strengths to areas that they can develop in their work. And unfortunately, most people don't feel like they're developing at work. And I think it's because we expect people to develop in the same way. And it starts with managers needing to feel that they're developing. So we that boss to coach journey that I was referring to earlier is a way to upskill managers so that they themselves are developing, so that they can learn how to have the right kinds of conversations. I think it's really hard for people to develop effectively if managers don't know what they're doing and if managers don't have ongoing conversations with them. We'd argue from our data, every manager at minimum should have at least one meaningful conversation per week with everybody they manage. If you just write that down as a minimum, one meaningful conversation a week. And the word meaningful is really important. And underneath that is, I've got to know a lot about what you're doing, your work, your role. I need to know your strengths. And I probably need to know something about what's going on in your life so that we can adjust to whatever situation you're in. But if I know those things, then I can have some really meaningful discussions with you about your development. I can notice times when you're excelling and give you feedback on that. I've built up some trust with you so that if there is something you need to improve on, we can have a candid conversation about it and it's fine. And you appreciate that, as opposed to feeling like you're always being criticized by your manager. Tristan, we asked people in one of our studies to relive their previous work day. And we asked them, first we measured how engaged they were in their work and knew something about how well they're developing. But we also asked them how much of their time they had spent doing what they do best, and then also how much time they spent doing what they don't do best, using their weaknesses. And the engaged workers reported doing what they do best four times the rate, so 4-to-1 ratio in comparison to doing what they don't do well. The actively disengaged workers, so these are the ones that are really negative about their organization, 1-to-1. So if we're going after balance, that's not the right answer. To develop people appropriately, we've got to be really thinking about what they do best and getting them. Doesn't mean you're going to have to, everybody has to do things they don't love to do in their work, but you need an abundance of people doing what they do best. And so the more that we can develop people so that they can get there over time. And part of that is as organizations grow, I know you mentioned a lot of entrepreneurs, small businesses. As your organizations grow over time, you're going to find that people can continually do more of what they do best and hand off things they don't do best that other people love to do that they don't love to do. And so the more you can evolve people that way as your organization grows so that actually happened in my career, where as I continued to progress, I was able to really learn more about what comes easy to me, what comes natural, what challenges me, what gets me interested, and some of the things that seemed like a burden to me, other people love to do. So I think that's the way it ought to work as organizations grow.
Dude, that makes a lot of sense. When you said the 1-to-1 for those people that aren't happy at the organization, that the very first thing I thought of was burnout.
Yeah.
Right? That makes so much sense.
That's what burnout looks like.
Dude, very good. 4-to-1, that I prefer that. That is so much better.
It's not a balancing act.
That's so true. That's so true. All right. So what about my opinions? Tell me about that, because that's right after my development.
Yeah, listening to people is so important, and it's often overlooked in management, where we, again, think that our job is to delegate all the time and that's our main responsibility. But the best managers are really good listeners, and they sit down with people and get their perspective. It doesn't mean that their perspective is always going to be used every time, but at least they'll know why, because you have a chance to explain that. It also relates to a sense of control, which has health outcomes. People need to come to work and feel like they have some autonomy and have some influence and some self-control. And opinions counting goes a long ways in that department. We listed off a number of studies in that book that we cite, some of the Whitehall studies that looked at some of the outcomes of where people didn't feel like they had autonomy. And it can have some really devastating health outcomes on people. So these elements of well-being are blended. They're interdependent, I would say. And that's a really important one. It's one that it's one of the most difficult ones for people to get right. But getting it right doesn't require a whole lot, if that makes any sense at all. People naturally get it wrong because they think they should delegate. But you can get it right just by sitting down with people and getting their perspective. That's not very hard.
You know, dude, I thought that out of all of them, I mean, they're all great and important, all right? But right now, I think that one just seemed to be so pertinent with the atmosphere that we live in. Right? Everybody's giving their opinions, and everybody kind of wants to force their opinion on you. And if you don't agree, well, you know, see you later, right? There's a problem. And I love that you said this, where you just shut up and listen, right? Because I think that's the key to this. As you want to grow your company and you sit down and you talk to these individuals that are working with you, you can better help them if you understand them. and you get their opinions, and they're valued, right?
One of the things, Tristan, that gets this toxic is disrespect, and it's hard to know what that means unless we really listen to people. And on the high end of it, respect. It'd be hard to respect somebody really if they don't feel like you're listening to them at all. So that's kind of underneath that too.
I love that, man. You mentioned that you did a study on it when you were seeking employment input. I wrote this down. Empower your employees, they'll live longer. You mentioned the Whitehall studies. Mm-hmm. And I loved reading that study. Do you by any chance remember that study well so you could tell us about it or no?
Yeah, well, they Michael Marmot was one of the co-authors of the study, and they studied civil workers in Europe, and they tracked them longitudinally. And they not only tracked their health outcomes, like new incidence of coronary heart disease and other outcomes, but they also measured their perceptions of their work. It's called Justice at Work, which is a sort of a measure of, it's very similar to what we refer to as employee engagement, but there's a big element of self-control that they studied, and autonomy. And the people that had more of that just lived longer and had much, longitudinally had much lower rates of negative health outcomes. And it makes a lot of sense. If you kind of were able to just write down how you felt every day at work and kept track of that over time, I think that you would notice that you're feeling something inside physiologically when you don't feel like you have self-control at work and when you don't feel autonomy. And opinions counting goes a long ways in helping people feel like they have some self-control when they come to work. We actually did another study that kind of helps to explain why those findings exist, where we track people in the moment. And we asked them, before we conducted this study, we measured their opinions counting and their engagement. And we found that in the moment, people that said they felt stress actually had more of the, physiologically had more of the stress hormone cortisol, which we measured through saliva samples. So we actually asked people questions in the moment, captured their saliva, and associated those things together. But people that were more engaged had less of the stress hormone cortisol as they're anticipating work in the morning. So if you think about those days accumulating like that, the other interesting thing to me is the people that had high interest in the moment had lower levels of cortisol. So you need moments with high interest, and it doesn't mean you have the absence of stress completely, because sometimes stress can help us get things done, but you don't want too much stress. And right now, our tracking of the global data, particularly here in the U.S. and Canada, stress is much too high. Even though engagement is higher here, stress is too. So we love our jobs, but we're stressing ourselves out because we don't have all these other elements aligned.
Dude, the one-to-one thing, I'm not going to forget that. The one-to-one, that's insane. And you know, you mentioned something really in between there, and it reminded me of you guys should start, for this book, you should start like a work journal, and it should have like these items right here, like my expectations, strengths, development, opinions. And then the last one, the purpose. Like I would love to just jump in if I'm part of an organization, be like, okay, well, how am I feeling today? My expectations met, or I think that's awesome. All right. So tell me about my mission or purpose. Tell me about that.
This is one that was particularly important as we tracked. We did a big study where we looked at past recessions and about 62,000 business units and compared them to non-recessionary times. And feeling connected to your mission or purpose or of the organization made people more resilient, made businesses better during tough times. Especially, but all the time, but particularly during tough times. I think people need to see how their work connects to something big as they're going through struggles, or else it's easy to just think about your work as tasks, and it's more easy to get stressed out. And that one I like to think of as they're all kind of elements of human nature. If you go back as far back as you want to go, and whatever your theory is of how long humans have been around, we started off in small groups. And we had to have something in common to be together. And, you know, whether we're chasing something or whether there's something else bigger going on. But we've got something inside us that wants to be a part of something bigger. And almost everybody has something, whether it's a sports team or whether it's church but why can't it be at work? Why can't your workplace be one of your big purposes in life that you're trying to get done to make the people around you better in one way or another? So I think it starts with an organization having a really clear mission or purpose that you can remember off the top of your head. Gallup's is to provide analytics and advice that improve the world one person and one organization at a time. I can attach all my work to that and connect to. I think every organization can have a mission or purpose like that. And the key to good management then is helping people see how their work does that. No matter what their job is, how does your work contribute to that bigger picture?
Dude, that's key right there, because there was one section in the book that I'm just going to read it out. It said, I wrote this down. Every company has a mission statement, but it's the manager who makes work meaningful, which brings everything together with what you said, right? We've got to have this meaningful conversation with the people that we manage at least once a week, right? I wrote that down. I'm like, damn, that's important. So that was really good. I love how you brought it all together. You know what it felt like after I read the book? It felt like it was a manual, because I kept on going back to it. I was like, whoa, this is, what was that over here? You put so much into this one, and it felt like the research just came all together. How do you feel about the book now that it's out there?
We've gotten just excellent feedback on it. We put a lot of effort in. You know, the COVID year still going on in a lot of parts of the world, but still going on here. But we're starting to get out of it. But that whole 2020, as I look back on it, it felt like a blur. But we put so much research into this book. But our goal was to summarize it in a way that was accessible to any manager or leader, and pull away some action points from what's been done. So we did a lot of work looking not only at our Gallup databases, but also looking at the academic literature that's been published on each of these topics that we're talking about, to pull out, here's what you can reliably do and that you can rely on to actually have a real impact according to the science that we've seen. So we put a lot of effort into it. We wrote a book just a couple of years ago called It's the Manager that was even more of a manual. So that's more of a manual for managers and moving on that boss to coach journey. This one kind of builds on top of that, saying we got to take it a step further. In that journey, we've got some tidbits of organizational leaders and managers based on the science, take it to the next level and impact people's overall lives. So that was our goal.
That happened with this one, because there was something you said at the very beginning that I wrote down. You said, work and life is more connected to work than ever before. And man, that is so true. Besides these devices, which you brought up being one of the reasons for that, why do you think we're there? And I think it's only just going to become even more and more true in the next few years.
Well, we were heading that direction because it was an expectation of the newer workforce pre-COVID. And then COVID just probably made it a permanent thing, because many people in this, so what we often call a forced experiment, learned that it can work that way, and it can work that way effectively. You've got about 30% of people that really want to be back permanently on location. And all the rest either want some kind of a hybrid model where you're coming and going in ways that are most comfortable for you. That's the biggest chunk. And then there's another about 20% that would prefer to be full-time work from home, which is four times what it was pre-COVID. But I think people learned a lot on both sides. There's a group of people that learned, I've got to be in the office to get my work done. And there's a big group of people that learned that the flex time thing they're asking for before really does, can and does work if you do it right. But what that does, Tristan, I think, is it puts even more pressure on how we manage people and how we coach them. It's hard to boss people when they're in that kind of environment, because the people with the boss mentality need to see what people are, you know, they need to have people visible to them all the time, so they know they're actually working. But if you get people in the right jobs and you know that people really do want to make a difference in their work, if you're hiring the right people and have a system in place for that, the hybrid kind of model can be very effective because it meets one of the basic needs we talked about earlier of autonomy. Most of what we see connects to engagement, well-being has a lot to do with autonomy and people, you know, being able to do things their own way. Even improving well-being, we shouldn't expect people to be athletes to have high physical well-being. We shouldn't expect them necessarily. They could be, but we shouldn't expect everybody to be a multimillionaire. They could be, but we shouldn't expect everybody to be that if they want to have high financial well-being. And we shouldn't expect everybody to have 10 more new friends to have high social well-being. Maybe they just need to get the most out of hang out with the highest energy people that they know, that bring them the most energy. But they need to do it their own ways, is the point I'm trying to make. And if they know their strengths, they can impact all those well-being elements in a way that's very unique to them. And they don't have to do anything miraculous to get there. They can do it in a way that's simple and that is effective for them.
Nice. So you're telling me it all starts with your strengths first. I can see the progression of this. So now I need to read Strengths 2.0, right? The manager book, and then your book right here, man. I love this.
And we've tried to summarize it all in this one too. So it isn't like you have to, but it'd be great if you did.
Dude, I love the progression, by the way. That was awesome. That was awesome. All right. So now that you've written the book, you look back at it and you say, okay, this is amazing, which it is, by the way. Everybody go pick it up. It's an amazing book. When you look back, you're like, okay, I wish I would have added this part to it. Is there anything like that you've looked at that you wish you would have added?
Well, I would say this, that during 2020, I've never seen data get old so fast. So usually the things we find, you know, don't change that much. They kind of gradually shift over time. We saw some big shifts in the data. And fortunately, by the time we published this, we'd captured, you know, a lot of those massive changes that were occurring. But I think we've got another wave of change coming up. So I think what I would want to add is what's probably coming, which is how workforces are evolving as they come back, and the decisions that leaders are making, and the effect of some of those decisions. I think people are going to learn a lot from the decisions they make on what they require people to do. And what effects those decisions have on their workforce. There's some leaders that might go too fast. You've got to be in the office full time. There are other ones that might not put the right skills in place for their managers to manage effectively in a hybrid environment. So I think leaders need to be real thoughtful about how they educate managers and kind of take them on that journey so they continually learn through their strengths, but also learn how to have the right kinds of conversations with people so that a hybrid model can work going forward.
Man, I see that. And I see one thing that was really apparent reading through the whole book was that leaders really now in our day and age, they need to have high emotional intelligence, number one, right? And mm-hmm. they also need to be very involved with the people that they're leading. And that was just super clear. I was like, whoa, that's damn. I need to go back because I need to work on some of that, Jim. So.
Well, for senior executives, you know, the first thing is to effectively manage the people that directly report to you. So if you get that right, then you're going to start what we sometimes call a cascade in the organization. But trust happens through that, as opposed to trying to, you know, impact every single person as your organization grows. But I would prioritize it that way. So executives need to be coaches too.
Yeah. And I think they forget that, right? Because we're so used to, if you're the one that started the company and not coming from an executive job, but more of an entrepreneur, right? You're the one that started it, funded it. You were the social media marketing, everything, right? And you forget that you have to function as more of a manager once you reach that role and saying, hey, let me help you and coach you while you do everything else. That's a great point, Jim. I love that, man. So look, everyone, please do yourself a favor. If you're looking to take your business to the next level, this was an amazing book. I was really surprised in a really good way. Well-being at work, how to build resilient and thriving teams. Pick it up. If you're not going to read it, get the Audible and follow Jim Harter on social media. Jim, anything you want to add here in closing, my friend?
I really appreciate you having me on, Tristan. We're open to anybody who wants to get a hold of us or learn more about Gallup. Just go to gallup.com. We share all of our latest research out there, research, not just the reports, but really short articles that people can pick up and read quickly. And I'm on LinkedIn if anybody wants to contact me there.
I'll be reaching out to you more, Jim.
Great. Thanks, Tristan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Those are all the brilliant thoughts that we have for you today. If you like what you're hearing, drop us a review or just tell your friends. This has been a Success Podcast. Head to success.com/podcast to hear more just like it.